I would like to know the difference, because, well, he's reacting to a theology or to a philosophy of concepts.
Yes.
And I know that insight is an act. It's an act of understanding, but there's also insight.
I mean, can I postpone that for about 10 minutes? Because when he gets into why he started the book Insight, mm-hmm. with mathematical examples, okay. he'll have something that I think will be pertinent to that question. So, if I could, mm-hmm. I'm not trying to avoid the question. It's obviously it's crucial to him. But I'd like to, and just in terms of it is part of this paper that we're discussing, but it comes up in just a little bit later. So could we do that, and then come to that at that point? Okay, thank you. We're coming right to it, because the next thing that I want to emphasize from this paper is 267, page 267. About 1943, I began collecting materials for an account of Aquinas's views. This is about five lines down from the top. Aquinas' views on understanding and the inner word. The result was a series of articles, what we've come to know as the Verbum articles, or now the book Verbum, in theological studies from 1946 to 1949. They took into account the psychological, metaphysical, and Trinitarian aspects of Thomas' thought on the subject. Now here, we're getting to the point that Jorge is just asking about right now. Their basic point, the basic point of these lectures, of these articles, is that Aquinas attributed the key role in cognitional theory not to inner words or concepts, but to acts of understanding. So, again, just a couple of lines later here, and I'll translate this into more contemporary language. What Aristotle and Aquinas held was that the human intellect abstracts from images, from phantasm, a preconceptual form of intelligibility. I'm giving you the language that we would use for these terms that he's using here. So we abstract from images a preconceptual form of intelligibility. Preconceptual form of intelligibility. And that later will become Lonergan's meaning of idea. The idea is the content of an act of understanding. And then it's from that that the word is spoken interiorly in conceptual form. How do concepts develop if there's no distinction between insight and concept? Then there is no way of accounting for conceptual development. Concepts develop because new acts of understanding arise. And so conceptual the development of a system, for instance, of a system of thinking. How does a system develop over time, whether it be in one person's mind or over history? You know, like Lonergan's thought is going to develop. It's developing now, even though Lonergan's dead. What he started is developing. And it's formulated, each development is formulated in concepts. But how can you account for? Concepts cannot account for their own development. They develop because there are new insights, new applications that are made through insight, new nuances that are grasped through insight. And those nuances, the reason that it's hard to distinguish is that those nuances themselves are, as they're grasped, they're preconceptual. That's why it's hard to distinguish between insight and concept, because you're basically distinguishing between something that's preconceptual and the concept, which by definition is not preconceptual, it is conceptual. All right, but there's something preconceptual that grounds it, and that's that grasp of some kind of intelligibility. I'll come to. I will do this right away, rather than postpone. I'll get into the something that I was going to do in a few moments, because it's right on this issue. One of the reasons that he says that he begins insight with mathematics is, and this is something that he didn't say in insight itself. He gives you, remember, if you remember the introduction to insight, he gives us several reasons why he's beginning the book with mathematics. But this one is something that he only really emphasized later. And I think maybe he only saw it later. But in geometry, Euclidean proofs, how much this is going to mean to each of you, I'm not sure. But Euclid's geometry, Lonergan says, frequently rests on valid but unacknowledged insights. And contemporary mathematicians go crazy over that. And they want highly formalized methods. But the danger of the highly formalized methods is that they will downplay the role of insight. So in Euclid, you've got concepts, conceptual, and Lonergan says the only erroneous thing in Euclid is that Euclid thought that his geometry was the only geometry. But otherwise, it's completely valid. It's just not the only one. But there are conceptual formulations in Euclid that don't follow from any other conceptual formulations in there. And this drives contemporary mathematicians crazy, because they want everything derived from every conceptual formulation to be able to be derived from another conceptual formulation. And Lonergan's saying it's at these points that Euclid's expressing an insight, formulating the content of an insight that he didn't acknowledge because it was preconceptual. But and so he has some examples of that, which I'm not enough of a mathematician to prove, to demonstrate for you. So that this is on page 269. 269.
At the bottom.
Yeah. Apart from its mistaken assumption of uniqueness, in other words, that it's the only geometry, Euclidean geometry is not mistaken. But this does not mean that it's rigorous in the sense of conceptually rigorous. Euclidean proofs frequently rest on valid but unacknowledged insights. Contemporary mathematicians employ highly formalized methods to avoid the use of insights that are not explicitly formulated. For what is not explicitly formulated is not subject to control. And later, on page earlier, at the top of page 268, when he's talking about his friend Eric O'Connor in Montreal, at the bottom of 267, when I began teaching at L'Immaculée Conception in Montreal, Father Eric O'Connor returned from Harvard with his PhD in mathematics and began teaching at Loyola College in Montreal. Later in a conversation, it transpired that he was having difficulty in his efforts to teach. I asked him, "Are you using these highly formalized methods so that every conceptual formulation has to be derived or deduced from another conceptual formulation? Is that the way you're teaching?" He said he was. And Lonergan said, "Scrap that. Concentrate on communicating to your students the relevant insights. And on that basis, the students will be able to figure out the formalizations for themselves." So, and in other places, he talks more about this conversation that he had with O'Connor. And he's telling him, go back to the diagrams. Give them the diagrams. And show them, create for them the conditions under which they can have an insight and understand something. And then you'll find that your teaching is a success. So it worked. My suggestion worked. He gave up this thing of trying to derive concept from concept. And instead, he started teaching by putting diagrams on the board and talking around the diagram enough so that the students could see the point by catching the intelligibility in the image and then coming to the formalization themselves. Does that help with this So image, insight, concept, rather than concept to concept, which is the highly formalization, highly formalized kind of thing. Greg and I were talking last week about how a lot of mathematical teaching does not give people the opportunity to have the insights, because it's concept to concept. And, you know, so then they end up trying to memorize. Memory is not understanding. But image, insight, concept is understanding. So he helped O'Connor, and then O'Connor helped Lonergan with the early chapters of insight, with his own knowledge of mathematics and physics. So he said I could consult him when writing the earlier chapters of insight. So that's some of the way in which, but it's difficult to talk about it, because to catch an insight is like trying to, we're aware of them without knowing it most of the time, you know. And once we've caught it and formulated it, then we're into concept already. But there's a preconceptual act that's grounded in that. And you can't account for systematic or theoretical development if you don't distinguish between insight and concept. You'll only get so far by deriving implications of concepts. Karl Barth, at the very beginning of the... And this is not... There's a lot in Barth that I find worth reading. I don't like his neglect of philosophy and so on and so forth. But in the beginning of the Church Dogmatics, he's got this language of analyte theology, the dogmatic theology or doctrinal theology, as a matter of analyzing concept. It isn't, you know. It's not a matter of analyzing concept. Doctrinal theology is a matter of determining what is the truth of Christian teaching. What does the church teach? What is the constitutive meaning of this community? And systematic theology is a matter of understanding that. And we understand it by constructing, by creative construction of systems to understand it. And those systems are always limited. There will always arise a question that cannot be answered within the framework of a given system. And at that point, that framework has to break down and the system has to expand. But it's question, insight, concept that is the way it moves on. A question arises. The concepts are not there to handle this question. Something's missing. And so people have to start thinking outside the box, you know. I'm sort of running on here, but I'm trying to get to the point that you were asking about. It's not the case, though, that Lonergan is arriving at insight by some kind of transcendental deduction, that we can't explain these things unless we posit something like insight. Because he's saying what he's trying to do in the book Insight is to get you to catch it in your experience, this preconception click, you know, the click. And I find it most when in these moments of when you know you're onto something and you can't quite put it into words yet. And that, to me, gives me the distinction between insight and concept. The knowing you're onto something is the emergence of an insight. And then the formulation of it is a later... There's insight involved also in the formulation, because you'll know that, yeah, that does it. This formulation doesn't quite do it, but that one does. Well, there's an understanding that's involved there, too. An understanding of the formulation itself. Am I addressing your question in any way? So it's a matter of catching it in act, you know? I think it's easier for us to catch... at least in some instances, to catch the act of reflective understanding, grounding a judgment.
But, you know, sometimes you just reach a point where you know it's diminishing returns from this point on in terms of asking any further questions. That's the act of reflective understanding. And so I assent or I negate either one, you know, either one. That sometimes is easier because we're more self-aware when we're reflecting on evidence to come to a judgment. That we're more present to ourselves at a heightened level than we are when we're not simply, but insights can occur in dreams. Kekulé's discovery of the benzene ring, the structure of the benzene ring, was a dream, you know. But when he woke up in the morning, he wrote it out, and it was there. But it was the circle biting its tail, you know, in the dream. And then he understood in the dream. It wasn't just that he saw a circle biting its tail, big deal, but this was the image, and in that image, there was, he grasped the answer to his questions.
Isn't that a primordial image?
It's a primordial image in mythology.
Yeah.
But he, in his dream, it was an image that gave him what he needed to answer the question that he was asking.
Isn't that interesting?
Because it's a circular. The structure of benzene is a ring. And he didn't know that before the dream.
Because I'm taking understanding primal religions, and that's something I'm just spreading
there. Yeah, it's a primordial, mystical symbol.
Yeah.
But in his experience, it was that primordial mystical symbol became the image in this dream, and it was a dream, it was a daydream. I mean, he was asleep, but he was sitting in his chair in his office, and he woke up and said, oh my God, that's it. Mm-hmm. It's a ring.
Mm-hmm.
It's not linear. But it was his question that was stirring up the unconscious to provide the image, you know, or the unconscious or whatever you want to call it, you know, or whatever wherever that came out of, to give it to him. And the insight was in that he understood in the dream, you know, and then conceptualized when he woke up.
Well, would you say that these three moments, Lovingen is kind of differentiating and relating here, image, insight, and concept, is something that, if you look at the history of Western philosophy, the Greeks, you know, you would find it there, but it has somehow been hidden because of later development. Because I'm thinking also of Hannah Arendt in her work, The Life of the Mind, where she kind of speaks of this.
Yeah.
And she speaks of the activity of the nous, and how then you have the activity of the logos.
Yeah.
So the nous has some form of an apprehension into being that then gets really formalized into concepts in the logos.
Yeah.
That does not really capture the nous, but it's grounded in that.
Yeah.
So you kind of see that working.
Yeah.
It's the structure, at least, the basic components.
I think that's what Lonergan discovered in that book by Stewart on Plato's Doctrine of Ideas, that it was there, you know, that it was there and that it was in Plato. And there's something of it that's in Aristotle as well. I think it's Augustine. I think that what Lonergan would say, and because I don't know these authors as well as he really read these people, and he read them in the original. But I think it's that Aristotle does definitely the insight into image. And what's clearer in Augustine is understanding grounding concept, grounding the word. And subject and soul, which is what he calls, is what he entitles the introduction to the verbum articles, is saying that basically Augustine is as much of an influence here as Aristotle. Because Aquinas depended on both of them. And Aristotle had insight into image, but Augustine had that insight grounding the concept, grounding the inner word. Because Augustine was concerned with trying to understand the divine word, so it was a theological concern for him. And it was Augustine who discovered the analogy is the our understanding speaks a word. So that was his analog for it. But it's probably more compactly present as well in those others. And later when Aristotle wrote. So, yeah. And then judgment is much more it's in Aquinas. But it becomes, I think, much more. I've written something on this. And I haven't published it. It's sitting on my computer in the stuff that I'm working on now. But I really think it was Newman, even more than Aquinas. For Lonergan had disengaged judgment, you know, as a distinct set of operations. but it has to be present as well in. It is present as well in Aquinas, but it isn't. Newman's into the beginnings of interiorly differentiated consciousness beyond metaphysics, or he's not a metaphysician, but he's into interiority in a way that Aquinas was, but didn't articulate that clearly. All right, where are we? We're at a quarter to four. And okay, so that's the Verum article. So then he begins working on insight, and I'll cover this rather quickly because you've read insight, and that's not the point of what we're about here. So what I'll do is photocopy these pages and give them to you next week. And I just want to move to where he developed beyond insight. So if we look at, we don't have to really study, I don't think, 269 over to 271. Well, 270, 271, chapters 6 and 7 of Insight are concerned with the operations of common sense intelligence. While this is the universal manifestation of intelligence, I mean, that's in everybody. We could say they don't have much common sense, but it does operate in that way in everyone. Insight into the particular circumstances of my own life, that's common sense. It's also the most difficult to objectify clearly and distinctly. Common sense is more at home in doing than in speaking, and its speaking is apt to be terse and elliptical, or else metaphorical, if not fanciful. So it's not like the speaking of a scientist or a theologian. It's a development of intelligence that's prior to that achieved in system, science, logic. And so it's prior to the systematic mode of differentiated consciousness. So on and so forth. Next paragraph, 271, because these are some developments, or at least things that it would be good for us to look at, and I haven't, one of them that I just really never had adverted to before until I read this the other day preparing for today. Chapter 6 touches on the bias of the dynamic unconscious, which is what I'm trying to get at with psychic conversion. Okay. So here I wish to take advantage, he wrote this before I had shared anything with him about psychic conversion. Here, so what he saw later, a couple of authors that he had not read when he wrote Insight. I wish to take advantage of this opportunity to draw attention to two works that I found very enlightening and in some measure to confirm the surmises I expressed in Insight. Herbert Fingeret, in a book called The Self in Transformation, conceived neurosis as cumulatively misinterpreted experience. Okay, so again, you've got experience and insight. But here it's experience and misinterpretation rather than interpretation. So neurosis results from cumulatively misinterpreted experience. Both the experience and the misinterpretation are conscious, though not adverted to, identified, named, distinguished from other experiences and interpretations. What is properly unconscious and as well the goal of the psyche's profound striving is the correct interpretation of the misinterpreted experience. So therapy for Fingeret is to move people from a misinterpretation to a correct interpretation of their experience. Now, with some people, that's enough. With others, there's much more affective healing, I'm convinced, that has to go on. That's cognitive behavioral therapy. And that's fine, and it does work. But there are some people where the trauma is much, much deeper than that. What I find interesting here is his next comment. Well, I found the fingerette thing interesting. But Eugene Genlin is a person that I've come back to just in the last couple of years. In a paper called A Theory of Personality Change, set himself the task of saying just what was meant by personality change and just how psychotherapy brings it about. I found it a most helpful study. And I'm just pointing that out to you because I think that Genlin and Lonergan came to acknowledge each other late in Lonergan's life. I believe Genlin is still alive. In fact, we invited him to the workshop here in August of 2004, but he doesn't like to travel anymore. He finds it too difficult because of age. So I found that very interesting, that Lonergan, this is 30 years ago, is referring to a paper that he read by Genlin. All right, the next thing is what he has to say about history. I'll go back to my own notes here. Comments, chapters 6 and 7 are also put into the context of Lonergan's notion of the dialectic of history. History, for Lonergan, and this goes way, we can see this back in the late 1930s for him. History is basically a matter of three dynamics working together. Progress, decline, and redemption. Or intelligence, sin, and grace. Intelligence, self-transcendent behavior being the source of progress, refusal of self-transcendence being the source of decline, and God's grace bringing about healing. So that's for him, Lonergan, and these are simultaneous. It's not like, you know, well, first of all, we progressed, and then we failed, and then God intervenes. No, all three are working at the same time. There is nature, there is sin, there is grace. Nature is intelligence, reasonableness, responsibility. Sin is refusal. Grace is healing. And that's what makes for history. So if humans always did what was intelligent and reasonable, what was really intelligent and reasonable, the implications would be an ever-increasing progress. But human beings can be biased, and so unintelligent and unreasonable in their choices and decisions. But there is a redemptive process resulting from God's gift of grace, which is given to all and manifested in Jesus. So the sundry forms of bias are presented in chapters 6 and 7. All right, so that's enough. The rest of it, you know, from insight, and I'm just trying to find things that are different here. And the next thing is a few pages on of something different. And that has to do with the chapter on being. Page 274. On being. So knowledge of being occurs in true judgments. But he says in insight, there's a point not made in insight that more about being, and it regards what he calls spheres of being. And I found this very interesting because in insight, being's identified with the real, ultimately. And now, being becomes, well, whatever can be intelligently grasped and reasonably affirmed is not just the real. Because you can have logical being, you can have intentional being, you can have mathematical being, you can have hypothetical being, and so on. This reminds me very much of the way Heidegger talks from Aristotle about being is said in many ways. Okay, and I think Lonergan's coming to see more of that here when he talks about spheres of being. Real being is known when the fulfilling conditions grounding a judgment are data of sense or of consciousness. But there are more restricted spheres of being when the fulfilling conditions are not data but some lesser requirement. logical, what satisfies criteria of clarity, coherence, rigor, mathematical, any freely chosen set of suitable postulates, with their conclusions rigorously drawn, hypothetical, an instance of the logical that has some likelihood of being relevant to an understanding of the data of sense or of consciousness. So he's kind of loosening up this notion of being in a way, without denying that still it's reached through understanding and judgment. But he's not identifying it exclusively with the real. The real is the most important, but being is whatever can be intelligently grasped and reasonably affirmed. Now, I don't know how important that is for... It's not all that important for where we're going to go here. I just wanted to call it to your attention because it's a development in his own thinking. From being, the book Insight moves on to objectivity, and so on page 274, he talks about his notion of objectivity as it is in Insight, and all I want to add to that is that in Method and Theology, he speaks of objectivity as the fruit of authentic subjectivity. That's a new formulation of the notion of objectivity. Objectivity is not reached in any other way than by being authentic subjects. And it's only through authenticity that we reach, through self-transcendence, that we reach objectivity. Okay, so where does he differ? And this, I think we will be able to finish these notes. The first three chapters on metaphysics in Insight remain valid for Lonergan later on, but some changes are introduced regarding material that he presented in chapter 17 of Insight. He finds unsatisfactory later on what in Insight was the notion of myth, because he says that's really not the way people are talking about myth today. They have a much more positive notion of myth, because the word myth does not just mean superstition, whereas in Insight he's pretty well talking about it as being something that's superstitious, something that's primitive, something that's... Whereas today we use the term myth to mean stories that express truths. So he says, I have to find another way of talking about what I want to say. And so he's suggesting symbolic expressions of positions and of counterpositions. So symbolic expressions of counterpositions is what he was trying to get at with his use of the word myth in Insight. And then further, he says, the account of mystery in chapter 17 of Insight really should be filled out with what I say about religious experience later on in chapter 4 of Method and Theology. And the only other point I want to make, let me finish this. Again, he finds less concrete than he would desire the material offered in chapter 17 regarding the truth of interpretation. This is presented in the bottom of 275 and the top of 276 in the article. Chapter 17 of Insight offered a systematic account of problems of interpretation. And he says chapters 7 through 11 of Method and Theology offer a more concrete expression and an orderly set of directions on what is to be done towards moving to the attainment of the universal viewpoint. And what is responsible for this development? Well, this is what I was talking about earlier. And he sums it up on 276, 277. What happened in... basically 277. The new challenge, the top of 277, first full paragraph on 277. The new challenge came from the human sciences, the Geisteswissenschaft, from the problems of hermeneutics and critical history. Those problems are not addressed in Insight. In the form in which they were alive in, for instance, Heidegger and post-Heideggerian thinking in Germany. From the need of integrating 19th century Diltai and so on, Schleiermacher, Diltai, 19th century achievement in this field with the teachings of Catholic religion and Catholic theology. This is why I say there's a further post-insight cognitive intellectual development in Lonergan, which is the hermeneutical. It was a long struggle that can be documented from my Latin and English writing during this period and from the doctoral courses that I taught on intellect and method, on system and history, on the method of theology. The eventual outcome has been the book, Method and Theology. So he would say that his book, Method and Theology, is far more informed by a hermeneutical consciousness than was insight. This period, if you want a good book, it's by Ivo Coelho, C-O-E-L-H-O, Hermeneutics and Method. He really studies this period. It's the post-insight period of Lonergan. Ivo Coelho. C-O-L-E-H-O. Hermeneutics and Method. University of Toronto Press, sometime within the last... I didn't put the date down, but it's sometime within the last 5 or 6 years. Toronto Press in their Lonergan series. Ivo was here for the workshop in 2004. But he's got a masterful treatment of Lonergan's wrestling with the problems of the meaning of meaning as it's raised in German philosophy and so on. The hermeneutics and Method traces his development through that period. All right, so then finally, we'll just finish, we'll take just a minute. In insight, I'm just reading from the last two paragraphs here. In insight, the good was the intelligent and reasonable. In method, the good is a distinct notion. So he's got a fourth level of consciousness. In insight, there are only three. And the good is compacted into the intelligent and the reasonable. It's compacted into knowing. So he's got this broader decision, broader notion of decision and the good. The good is intended in questions for deliberation. Is this worthwhile? Is it truly or only apparently good? It is aspired to in the intentional response of feeling to values. It is known in judgments of value made by a virtuous or authentic person with a good conscience. It is brought about by deciding and living up to one's decisions. Again, in the next paragraph. In insight, the treatment of God's existence and nature failed to provide the explicit context towards which the book was moving. In method, the question of God is considered more important than the precise manner in which an answer is formulated. And our basic awareness of God comes to us not through our arguments, not through our choices, but primarily through God's gift of love. So he's, again, criticizing his own work on insight there. So that's basically it. And those latter comments lead directly into what I want to study next week, which are the papers on philosophy of God and theology. And those are in volume 17, pages 159 to 218. So that's about 50 pages of reading that I would ask you to do for next week. I'll take responsibility for conducting the class next week. I'm going to say there's only three of you taking it for credit. I'd like each one of you, if you would, to pick up one of those days where you might want to leave the class. Is that okay? But I don't want to impose more than that. If we had 12 in here, it would be easy for me because I could divide things around. But I'll take most of them. But if you could say, well, there's something I'm really interested in here, and volunteer to me that you would take one of these, but I'll do it next week and probably the week later or something. Just at some point to give me a break more than anything else, and so that we make this a seminar. I would like to hand it over to you, if you don't mind, for one class. And it can be whatever one you want to do.
That means the whole meeting? All the readings for the entire meeting? Is that what we are?
Well, we could come up with another way of doing it. Like, you could take one reading. And, yeah, that would be fine.
And could we meet with you and go over what
we're going to
do?
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. So if you wanted to take one reading, then maybe you might want to take one for 1 week and one for another week or something like that. So, let's be flexible. No rigid formalization. People don't learn from rigid formalization. So, and it's just a matter of, first of all, how can we make this something of a seminar? Mm-hmm. So, and that's where students take the responsibility. And then to get you involved. because otherwise, you know, you're always listening to the same person all the time. Okay, so that's
thanks, Bob.
So we'll do that. And if you don't have those books, you can purchase them at any time from Debbie. Or yeah, she's really the one to deal with because she keeps the money over there. But okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.